the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you joined us this week. Every week, we strive to bring you interesting individuals in the world of exercise and sports medicine, and this week is certainly no exception to that rule. We are pleased to have in-house a guest here at Texas A&M, Dr. Marcus Byman from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you before we get going here. Marcus got his PhD in physiology from the University of Florida. He's currently a professor in the Department of Cell Developmental and Integrative Biology, and he is in medicine and nutrition science as well. He is the director of a recently new center at University of Alabama, Birmingham, the Center for Exercise Medicine, and the associate director for the Center of Aging. He has currently over 60 publications. He's funded through the NIH in a couple of different mechanisms and through the Veterans Affairs Office as well. He is a former competitive soccer and basketball player in his younger days, is what he says, but I can vouch he's still a very competitive individual. Again, we're so glad to have Marcus with us. Again, thank you for being with us today. We're going to start with an easy question today.
Okay.
What got you into science?
That's a good question. I think what drew me to science, and particularly to exercise science, was my own pursuits in sport and trying to understand what makes a muscle tick and how best to make it adapt. And I think that's what led me to it. I became very interested in muscle mass regulation and muscle performance, and have since taken that to sort of out of the athletic world and into the disease world. Very much interested in maximizing mechanisms that promote muscle hypertrophy for those folks who have suffered atrophy from a variety of chronic states. So that's where it all started for me.
And you've done a lot of work in the muscle area. We'll leave it at that for the time being. Worked with NASA and a variety of other places. So tell us a little bit, help the audience understand kind of the things that happen to skeletal muscle as we age. Why should we be worried about skeletal muscle?
Well, over the course of, you know, from age 30 to 80, there is a nonlinear decline in muscle mass. It kind of speeds up after age 50. And by, you know, if we're fortunate enough to live to 80, we're probably going to end up losing about 40% of our muscle mass.
We lose our muscle as we get older.
30 to 40%. And the consequence of that, there's a variety of consequences of that. Some of it is physical impairment. So the ability to actually move your body weight around becomes very challenging. There's also a metabolic consequence. We need that muscle mass so that we can regulate a variety of bodily functions. And one of those key functions is the ability to regulate blood sugar. And if we have 40% less muscle, it makes it much more challenging to regulate our blood sugar levels. It makes us more susceptible to some problems, diabetes being one of them. So our objectives in terms of research are twofold. One is understanding why that atrophy occurs. The loss of muscle mass is called atrophy. And two is how can we stop it? How can we reverse it? So, and reversing it means intervening on people who have already suffered it. But the other and really more important question is, at what age do we need to intervene to even prevent it from happening? So we sort of study all those things, and on the short term, we do a pretty good job of reversing some of that atrophy. We can probably get to that.
Well, I was going to, you just led into a couple natural questions there, and that is, what age do we need to start worrying about intervention?
Well, you know, if you read the literature, most things will tell you that the fifth or sixth decade is when this becomes a big issue. But our work, and I think a couple of other labs would not necessarily support that. I mean, our work suggests that we see changes in muscle that are deleterious, in other words, bad, that are starting in our 30s. So I don't think it's safe to wait until you're 50, 55 and decide it's time to do something.
Now, what are the best interventions?
Well, pharmacologic interventions have been tried. Mm. Any pharmacologic treatment in isolation doesn't seem to work very well and has some side effects associated with it. So testosterone therapy, growth hormone therapy, there's a hormone called insulin-like growth factor 1 that's been attempted as a therapy. They don't work really that well. They're really the most effective treatment is some form of resistance training or what we call strength training. It restores function really, really well and restores muscle mass. Not fully, but we're getting closer to understanding how maybe to manipulate that prescription to make it better. But we can certainly rejuvenate some of that lost muscle mass quite well.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked on the podcast with several folks before who have talked about just what you've said, advocating resistance training for older individuals. We'll say above 30 is older at this point. And you're coming at this from a different aspect than some of the other folks have. So you're really saying that resistance training helps us maybe bring some of that muscle mass back, as well as bringing function back.
Yeah, there's two aspects to that muscle loss. One is, without getting too technical, we lose the size of individual muscle cells, or what we call muscle fibers, goes down. Particularly one class of those cells, which are called the type 2 fibers. But the other important thing that happens is we lose total number of cells. So muscle behaves much like neurons or nerve cells in the brain. You lose them, you don't regain them. So these cells are what we call terminally differentiated. They can't divide and create new ones. So once they're gone, they're gone. And as a person ages, if they wait too long, some of the muscle cells are gone and cannot be replenished. All we can do is intervene on the existing cells and make them bigger.
So this is a function of not making more cells, but it is making them bigger.
Yeah, that's the only thing that resistance training is able to do. I mean, we cannot force a muscle into a state where it actually generates new cells or new fibers. That only really happens in a situation where a muscle has been severely injured. It's a traumatic state for the muscle, and that process of recruiting what we call stem cells for the muscle and regenerating a fiber, that's really only in times of fiber replacement. It doesn't mean that there's an additive effect. Somehow the muscle knows how many fibers it wants to have, and if a few of them get essentially killed off, they can be replaced. But we can't take an older person who has lost 20 to 30% of their total cell number over the years, and we have no mechanism for restoring that number. All we can do is grow the existing ones.
Right. Now, I know there was a controversy for a while, I don't know if that's still there or not, that if you put older individuals on a resistance training program, their fibers didn't necessarily get bigger, but they certainly gained function back. Has there been more work on that? Do their fibers hypertrophy or get bigger?
Some people, they do quite well.
No matter the age.
No matter the age. It won't happen in 100%. With 100% confidence, I can say we can improve strength, improve power, improve some of the functional aspects of, you know, some of the things that an older person is suffering from in terms of decline. But in terms of restoring muscle fiber size or inducing some level of muscle fiber growth, we find that about two-thirds of them, we find that that's quite successful, but about one-third are pretty resistant to it.
But that's enough people that you would certainly make a general recommendation that if you're over the age of 30, you need to think about some form of resistance training.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think even the folks that we would call sort of delayed responders or non-responders, you know, our research is actually going in the direction of trying to address those people and trying to understand what makes them not respond to the typical program.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all ready to say that there are true non-responders out there. I think what we're finding is that there is a particular segment of the population that needs an alternative prescription.
Yeah.
So that's what we're testing.
I know that there was some work in the probably early 90s, late 80s, where they took very aged individuals. I think 80 years old, Maria Fiataroni's work in particular. And with resistance training that was appropriate for that age group, I mean, they found amazing increases in functionality. They were able to walk without support, for example.
Right.
Are you guys seeing the same thing in the results, the work that you're doing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we have not actually intervened on people beyond age 75. We've tested many people, and our oldest person that we've tested is about 84.
Mm-hmm.
But our intervention studies, the long-term trials, have been 60 to 75-year-olds. We think that that's a really important segment mm-hmm. of the population that we want to intervene on them because based on sort of our cross-sectional comparisons, we think they haven't really suffered a lot of fiber loss yet.
Right.
They've suffered atrophy, obviously, but in terms of losing individual fibers in number, we think that happens a little bit later.
Yeah. Now let's just deal with a misconception up front. When you're talking about resistance training for older individuals,
mm-hmm.
you're not talking about necessarily having them go in and try to lift 1,000 pounds dead weight or
no.
the squats or what kind of, when you talk about resistance training, what kind of training are you actually talking about?
Well, we're talking pretty traditional in terms of the intensity, but the misconception is that older individuals are more susceptible to injury and that, you know, you can't go too heavy and you can't be too intense with it, and it's just not true. Everybody's relative intensity is exactly that. It's relative to their own individual maximum capability. So if I take a 20-year-old, I'm going to recommend that they probably strength train with 65 to 85% of their maximum capability.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have a 75-year-old, I'm going to recommend the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a really, I think, a thorough job of familiarizing people, regardless of age, to make sure that when we test them for maximum strength, that it's truly a maximum.
Mm-hmm.
So in our current studies, we take older adults and train them for 4 weeks before we even count their strength data.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to be very familiar with the movements, be good at the movements, be confident and comfortable in doing them before they really start to exert maximum effort. And even though they feel like they are near the, you know, the first 1 or 2 weeks, they may feel like they're doing something at maximum, but they really haven't fully appreciated what muscle mass they do have.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to activate it.
Right.
So over a 4 week period of time, there's a big learning curve. And once you get them to truly give you a maximal effort, and we can do this and actually verify it quite well because we have a device that we can electrically stimulate the muscle and determine whether they're truly giving us maximum effort voluntarily. At that point, you can start training them with the same percentage of max that you would any person at any age.
Yeah.
The question really becomes not so much the contraction intensity. I think the bigger question is the volume and the frequency and all the other dosing variables that you can manipulate. I don't necessarily think that over the course of 6 months or 12 months, the prescription for a 75-year-old and the prescription that's ideal for a 25-year-old look the same.
Hmm.
But time will tell, you know, and I think as we move more towards sort of personalized medicine and understand the interaction between a person's genetic profile and their sort of a manifestation of that profile, what we call their phenotypic profile, I think we're going to find that we can't necessarily say that this program is the best program for everyone of this particular age.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to find that there are people who respond differentially to various prescriptions, and we're a long way from understanding that.
Yeah. When you do a resistance training program for an older individual, is recovery time different? I know kind of the rule of thumb is you take a day off when you're younger to let that muscle recover. Do you see that same kind of recovery time for the older individual when you train them?
Well, we're testing that at the moment. We've gotten quite a bit of success with younger people training every 2 days.
Hmm.
So that day off, as you described. In the older population, we, you know, some people respond quite well to that exact same program.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt like sort of the stem cell biology that's happening, the protein synthesis machinery that needs to be turned on and the inflammatory response that needs to be sort of minimized, we thought an extra day of recovery would be better.
Mm.
So we've been testing them, training them every third day as opposed to every other, and comparing that directly. I'll share a little bit of that later today, I guess, but what we're really finding is that the older adult likes to be stimulated, their muscles like to be stimulated 3 days a week, but if one of those 3 days, particularly the middle day, is at a lower intensity,
mm-hmm.
it seems to work out right really well.
Hmm.
So we've adopted this concept of high, low, high,
mm-hmm.
Monday high, Wednesday low, Friday high. Hmm. And it's in a head-to-head comparison between high, high, which will be Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then just Monday, Friday, high, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're adapting quite well to that intermediate program where they come in and they do some relatively low-intensity work on Wednesdays. So,
well, that's great. Do you see any difference between the men and the women? I mean, we've talked about older individuals in general,
yep,
and we haven't segregated that, but we may have listeners go, wait a minute, women don't have the same testosterone levels.
Right.
So they, do they respond the same?
Well, on the 3 days per week program, high intensity, when we sort of compared young and old,
mm-hmm,
and obviously men and women within that those two age groups, the older women did better than the older men.
Really?
Yeah, they did better. And I think it's because of their starting point. So they actually have much smaller fibers to start with. So their muscles have atrophied much more. And I think that even though they were small fibers, they hadn't really lost some of their other characteristics that made them responsive to this additional activity. So they were able to actually just sort of restore protein in those cells quite well. Whereas the men, their fibers hadn't atrophied as much. Their muscles were smaller, indicating that they had lost more fibers in number. And so taking what was relatively an average cell size and trying to make it really big to account for what they probably lost in number, it makes for a really interesting gender comparison.
Yeah.
The women respond really well. In the current project where we're actually comparing doses, four different doses directly, I can't tell you what dose is ideal for men and women, but I do think based on our preliminary results, they're not going to be the same.
Really?
Yeah, so I think we'll end up recommending that women of, you know, in the 60 to 75 year old age bracket will probably have a recommended prescription from us that's different from the one we give to men.
Interesting. So we'll keep an eye out for that literature.
Yeah.
You know, and one other thing, I guess, myth before we leave, I mean, we still hear in the business this myth that women don't want to lift weights because they're afraid they'll bulk up.
Oh, yeah.
You want to address that at all?
I hope, particularly in the younger age groups, I think we're seeing that that's sort of fading away now. I think younger women are recognizing the value of strength training, and I think there's just an educational component that the older generations need to understand, but those who volunteer for our studies get it. And I don't think they have a fear of bulking up. I think their fear is more about getting up and down a set of bleachers at their grandson's football game, or maintaining their balance, you know, up and down their own stairs at home, or being able to do tasks around the house, or even higher levels of activity. You know, maybe they enjoy hiking, maybe they enjoy bicycling, whatever the case may be. They're more concerned about improving their functionality, and they see strength training based on a lot of the coverage in the media over the last 5 or 10 years that, hey, they shouldn't be afraid of weight training. In fact, it has a lot of great benefit. So I hope that that's being, that's sort of fading away. But that has been traditionally, I mean, if we were having this conversation 25 years ago, that would be the number one fear of women, right?
Right.
And what I, you know, if someone brings that fear to me, it's an easy response. And the response is even the men can work as hard as they can possibly work. And you know, yes, there will be visible changes, but you don't have to worry about a man at any age, really. If they begin strength training, they're not going to be, you know, an NFL linebacker next year.
Right. It's just
the average person will respond to this type of training in a beneficial way, but it's not something that's going to result in excess bulk.
I bet you've had amazing success stories from your subjects that have gone through. I'm sure they've come back and shared with you things they can do now that they couldn't do. You have any of those stories you want to share with us?
Those are always fun.
Well,
one I actually mentioned just a second ago. It was a true person, you know, a participant in our studies. She came in with real difficulty maintaining balance, and she sort of had a right to left sort of asymmetry as she as she moved and walked, and was much less confident on one side than the other. And over time, got much stronger, got more balanced. And her main reason for enrolling, honestly, she told me the first week, was that her grandson, you know, played high school football. And she was bound and determined to go to every game and climb those bleachers, and there's no handrails, and they're open bleachers. And so that was sort of her goal, and it worked out. We had another woman, She contacted me after we call them graduates when they graduate. Mm-hmm. So when they finish the studies, and some of these studies are, up to 9 months long. And so when a person reaches that milestone, we give them a T-shirt and some other things, and they're alums. She contacted me about 6 months or a year later and was very happy to report that she had ridden her bike across the state of Georgia.
Wow.
And she was about 68, 69 at the time.
Wow.
Got in with a group, and, she said, 2 years ago I never would have dreamt of even attempting this. And
yeah.
So she became a very strong advocate, and actually, other people entered the study based on her comments. And, once you get some success that affects somebody in the real world,
mm-hmm.
your recruitment sort of, the advertisements are not necessary. It's
right.
all word of mouth.
Right.
The program kind of speaks for itself at that point.
Right.
So we have a current project I just mentioned, which is having, I think, an important impact on people's lives, and that's in older adults, but not just older adults. These are aging adults with Parkinson's disease.
Really?
And so folks who suffer from tremor, mm-hmm. they suffer from balance abnormalities, they suffer from a variety of things that influence their mobility and their fatigue. And we're doing basically the same thing, high-intensity strength training. Within the person's maximum capabilities, everybody can do the same
right.
relative work.
Right.
And they're seeing great benefits of it.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, as scientists, we often talk more about finding the money to do our work and the research design and whether or not this study got published or not. But it's, I think in the end, it's a validation when you have subjects like that that do so well, and the majority of the subjects do well in this. This really does validate what you do as a scientist, doesn't it?
It does. In fact, a few years ago, we weren't really savvy about that. And just in the last maybe 3-4 years, we've actually made it a point to ask for anecdotes.
Mm.
So we didn't, before if somebody offered a story, we would love to hear about it, but we never really made it a part of the protocol. Now we sort of introduced this qualitative component.
Mm-hmm.
And so once a week, we will ask, each participant, give us the good, bad, and the ugly this week.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think this program was doing? What have you seen in your daily routine that has gotten better? Have you been more tired? Have you had other problems? I mean, we want to hear about it all. And we're getting some good feedback that way.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
That's super.
Yep.
Well, we're running short on time here.
Okay.
And we always give our guests an opportunity to give us a take-home message. So if there's one thing that you want our audience to remember from this podcast today, what do you think it would be?
Well, I guess I'll just sum it up and say the Fountain of Youth is the water cooler at the weight room.
There you go. Very good. Very good. Marcus, I want to thank you for being with us here today. It's been great to have you.
Thanks very much for having me. Enjoyed it.
And thank you all for downloading and taking the time to listen. But we're not going to get away here yet without having the question of the day for your T-shirt. And so we have one of our producers, Kelly Summon, actually has joined us, and she's going to be asking the question of the week.
What is the most effective intervention to restore muscle mass?
Thank you, Kelly. So that's our question of the week. So be the first one to send us the correct answer via email, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts that we have. Actually, one of our other producers, Cheryl, is modeling one today. It's too bad it's not video or you could see it today. So again, be the first one to send us that email and you'll get that podcast T-shirt. Again, thank you for joining us, taking the time to be here with us today. And we hope that you download us and you're with us again next week when we have another interesting individual in exercise science with us. And we hope in the meantime that you stay active and stay healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer, made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closings are provided by johnmilesproductions.com. Music was provided by David Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.